Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Dr. Sandra Steingraber. Steingraber is an ecologist, author, and cancer survivor. She is the author of two highly acclaimed books, Living Downstream, An Ecologist Looks at Cancer and the Environment, and her follow-up, Having Faith, An Ecologist's Journey to Motherhood. In 1997, she was named a Ms. Magazine Woman of the Year, and she is currently a distinguished visiting scholar at Ithaca College. Welcome to the show, Sandra.
Thank you.
Listen, your journey exploring what the environment is doing to us really began in 1979 at the age of 20 when you were diagnosed with bladder cancer. Tell us about that.
Well, that's true, it did. I was in between my sophomore and junior years in college at the time, and I was a biology major, so it didn't take me too long once I was back in college again to learn that the kind of cancer I had, bladder cancer, is considered a quintessential environmental cancer. You know, when I asked the question, why me, the question that all cancer patients ask eventually, I ask it in a very biological way rather than a metaphysical way. Mm-hmm. And so when I looked into the causes of bladder cancer, all arrows pointed toward the environment. Now, I wasn't the first in my family to develop cancer. You could really say that cancer does run in my family. In fact, my mother and I were in treatment at the same time for cancer. My mother had been diagnosed with breast cancer when I was 15 and then had a metastasis by the time I was 17. So her prognosis was always worse than mine. I also had an aunt who died of the same kind of bladder cancer that I was diagnosed with, several uncles with colon and prostate cancer. But the punchline to my story is that I'm adopted. Mm-hmm. So I also knew that what runs in chromosomes is not necessarily the same as what runs in families. Families share a lot more than just genes in common. We often share airspace, drinking water supplies, food, all kinds of different habits. So I became interested early on as a biologist in the environmental contributions to human health. Mm-hmm. And that's
And what did you find out when you started on this journey trying to explore where in the environment you might have received some of these cancer cells?
Well, first of all, I spent a lot of years just in libraries collecting, you know, file folders full of data. And it really wasn't until the early 90s when the breast cancer movement in the United States became radicalized, mostly by lesbian activists who had been working really hard with ACT UP and other anti-AIDS organizations in helping redirect scientific inquiry about the behavior of HIV virus and demanding that we protect public health and practice prevention, even in the absence of scientific proof. You know, we didn't know about everything about the behavior of HIV in 1985, mm-hmm. but we had to tell people how to keep themselves safe with the best knowledge that we had. We were working in a moving stream of data at that point. And I was actually involved with education work as a young professor myself at that time. And then what I saw happen were these very politicized lesbian activists who began to realize that breast cancer was decimating their communities as much as AIDS was decimating their brethren, and began to try to do the same thing for breast cancer, which has been done for AIDS, which is ask, you know, what's the underlying cause of this? What about the link between the environment and breast cancer? And essentially, these activists in the early 90s opened up a critical space in our culture to talk about the environmental links to cancer. And I have to say that activism really redirected me as a biologist. I mean, I was quietly working on this, but I never had told anyone that I had had cancer myself. Mm. And it wasn't until the speak outs of the 90s where I was actually invited to talk about my own autobiographical experience that I really kind of came out of the closet and then joined forces with this activist movement. Now, that eventually led me to serve on President Clinton's National Action Plan on Breast Cancer, and most recently now I help advise the state of California, which uses their cigarette tax revenue to fund breast cancer research, on which lines of inquiry around environmental causes of breast cancer do we want to direct research dollars down. Mm-hmm. So my work as a biologist and a cancer advocate are certainly informed by my early experience, but I have to admit that it was more than 10 years after my own diagnosis when I really was inspired to bring my own life and my scientific life together.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's incredibly effective. It's a very powerful book. And then you go back to where you were brought up in Illinois and trace some of the, you know, the rivers and lakes where you played as a child, and you discovered clusters of cancer in certain areas. So talk to us more about that.
Well, in the early 90s when I was toiling away as a biology professor and by night working with these different breast cancer activist groups, and writing essays on what we knew about breast cancer and the environment, I realized that there was really a disconnect between what we in the scientific community understood about the environmental causes of cancer, which is quite a lot, actually, and what the public knows about those environmental connections, which at that time was very little. And so I actually just left my position as a professor in Chicago, and with the help of a wonderful fellowship at Harvard, went off to kind of reinvent myself as a science writer, somebody who could bridge that gap, who could build a bridge over the breach between what the scientific community knows and what the public knows. And that's what I've done ever since. So I moved to Boston and spent a year in probably the best medical library in the world, the Harvard Medical Library, with 7 research assistants, looking at the scientific evidence and piecing together a giant jigsaw puzzle piece on what all the studies were that helped us understand the environment's link to human cancers. And those range from studies of occupational data. We know that, for example, people who work as golf course superintendents have higher rates of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma than the general population. And so do farmers. Mm-hmm. And so do Vietnam veterans exposed to Agent Orange. And so that's one. Occupational data tells us one thing. Studies of dogs and cats tell us something else. Mm-hmm. Cancer maps tell us something else. So I did all that work at Harvard. And then I moved back into my sister's basement in 1994, back in my hometown of Illinois, and tried to deploy whatever skills I had as a kind of environmental detective in my home community. So I took a look at the cancer registry data, the toxics release inventory data, where we were seeing cancer clusters, where we knew we had a problem with toxic waste. Mm-hmm. So when I wrote the book Living Downstream, then it's really 2 books in one. On the one hand, it's my best attempt as a biologist to summarize that body of evidence for the public. But I also hopefully create a compelling human story that's really a love story between myself and my hometown, with me as the lover and my home community as my beloved. Uh-huh. Yeah. And even though it's terribly a toxic place, I think it's also kind of an every place USA. So what I found buried in the local landfill near the house where I grew up is probably a story that's replicated in a lot of hometowns. Mm-hmm. What I found in the drinking water wells, what I found out about the pesticide plant right near my high school that formulates pesticides banned for use in this country but which are shipped abroad, is probably a story that other people could find in their household. So my hope was the book would be a kind of blueprint for other people who wanted to be environmental detectives in their home communities as
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm. You're often referred to as following in the footsteps of Rachel Carson, who most of our listeners probably know was a government worker and ended up as sort of the mother of the environmental movement when she published Silent Spring in 1962. Now, are you surprised that people didn't seem to heed her warning back then? Because you're looking at this 40 years later, and it seems like it's still pretty toxic.
It is, although Carson really changed. She did kind of construct the vineyards in mm-hmm. which I now labor, and she brought a lot of change about, really. The Environmental Protection Agency, for example, would never have been formed without her insistence that something be done about the environment at the executive branch of government. Now, it's ongoing corruption and impotence is another story, but she did do that. And I think she would have done a lot more had she not herself died of cancer 18 months after Silent Spring was published.
Yeah, and she was very young, too, wasn't she?
In her 50s, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, you say in Living Downstream that those of us born in the 40s, 50s, and 60s are the first generation to eat synthetic pesticides in our pureed vegetables. I found that a shocking statement. And so have we remedied that? Can we still say that about kids being born in the 70s and 80s?
That's a really good question. Yeah, we can, although things are nevertheless different. I mean, I was born in 59, so I'm part of that sort of baby, at the end of that baby boom era. And we are the first kids born after World War II to receive pesticides in breast milk, for example. Those were discovered in 1951. They were in our baby food. They were the sort of chemicalization of our economy that began with World War II.
Yeah. After World War
II. Right, when all these kind of chemicals essentially of mass destruction, these chemical weapons of war, were brought home, given a hero's welcome, and then turned into backyard weed and cockroach killers. And so suddenly we all had very intimate contact. You know, they even put DDT in blankets to moth-proof them, and they put it in paint so that a fly could land on your wall and die, you know. And so, so we are the first ones to be exposed as kids. So I'm interested in my generation as we now go through the various stages of our lives to see how those early exposures might have affected parts of our health. Now, I'm happy to say that a lot of things are better now than they were. DDT in breast milk is way down. So are dioxins and a lot of other things. And that's thanks to activists who are inspired by Carson to ask for the worldwide elimination of the use and production of a lot of these nasty toxics. And I was part of a UN treaty negotiations that began that process and was directly inspired by Carson's work. So given all the data on the great benefits of breast milk, for example, and then I also looked a lot at the contamination of breast milk, I made the decision to breastfeed my own two children, and I'm still nursing after 7 years. So, you know, clearly our breast milk now, as mothers now, is a lot cleaner than it was in the 70s and 80s. So that's a good thing. On the other hand, there are things that were not a problem when you and I were kids that kids now face. And those are, in some cases, similar chemicals and in some cases different chemicals. Flame retardants that are used in, especially in the computer industry, is a much bigger problem than it used to be. And, you know, the need to make sure that a computer doesn't burst into flames when it overheats is real, but so is the need to make sure that we're not being exposed to flame retardants that laboratory studies show can interfere with our hormone messaging systems. So that's an ongoing problem.
But what about weed killers and stuff that were derived after World War II from DDT and stuff? Are they safer? Because people are certainly still using them.
They are and they aren't. I mean, some pesticide use in lawn and gardens is actually going down, and organics is going up. So and organic food is the fastest growing sector of agriculture, and of course, the big brouhaha right now is because Walmart is suddenly wanting to buy organic food, and they are the largest retailer of food in America, and what Walmart wants it gets. So that decision alone may change the face of agriculture, and a lot of people are wondering if thereby organic standards will be loosened. And I don't have a crystal ball to know how that's all going to play out, but it's certainly a sign of our times. So, and even the United Nations now is officially recommending to farmers in developing nations to invest in organic agriculture, not only to protect the health of their communities, because in terms of cash crops, the higher premium that they can be sold for will actually enriches the community. And we know that organic agriculture has now become so sophisticated that it's not like we have to choose between high yields and no pesticide residues. You know, the old argument was that the whole world, we couldn't feed this starving, bulging world without the use of pesticides. That argument, which Carson heard every single day at the end of her life, is gone, because the data now show that organic farmers have high yields and on par with conventional farmers, and leave the soil in much better shape than conventional farmers, and don't pollute the groundwater when they grow the food. So we don't have to choose between poisoned water and high yields.
But you mentioned in your book, I do believe that some of the soil has been, you know, compromised prior to people becoming organic farmers. So, I mean, we still are at risk in some ways to have contaminated food, right? I mean,
Your organic carrots are going to have some pesticide residues too, simply because a chemical like DDT can persist in the soil up to 50 years in some cases. On the other hand, those concentrations, presumably, just as they are in breast milk, will be going down as we embrace more organic methods.
Yeah, one would hope. You know what else you mentioned in your book is about how many products now derived from oil were once manufactured by vegetation? Well, why did they switch over? It seems like it would be cheaper to manufacture from vegetation.
Oh, I think there are all kinds of different reasons. Certainly, when the when Henry Ford came up with the automobile, the original fuel was supposed to be ethanol. But there was also this great need in the oil refining industry to find a market for gasoline, because at that point, gasoline, kerosene, and the lighter fractions of chemicals that come out of a barrel of oil were basically just waste products. And that was one of the reasons that we put gas in our car instead of ethanol today. And the revving up of the synthetic chemical industry during World War II was originally intended to substitute for a lot of natural products like Japanese silk, which we could no longer get a hold of, and other blockades, Chilean saltpeter, you know, which was a natural fertilizer we couldn't get, nor could the Germans. And the Germans ended up inventing artificial fertilizers. It also worked really well as explosives,
right.
And that's why the federal building in Oklahoma was blown up. So both the Nazi powers as well as the Allied powers, because of trade blockades, weren't able to get a hold of a lot of, you know, rubber, silk, these natural plant-based things, and so we went to work figuring out how to make nylon.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the war was over, we dropped the bomb. Suddenly, the war was over, but we had all these stockpiles, and we had figured out all this chemistry. And so our economy really became chemicalized.
Yeah, yeah. Now, in your book, and I don't know if we might need an update on this, you mentioned that cancer rates in the Northeast Coast, Great Lakes, and the mouth of the Mississippi River were the highest when you were doing your study.
For certain cancers, yeah.
Yeah.
That's true for breast,
yeah.
Colon, and bladder cancers. You tend mm-hmm. to see certain cancers cluster around areas that are highly industrial. On the other hand, if you take a look at non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, the hot spots for those cancers are very different geographically. If you can imagine kind of a blank map of the United States, the hot spots for non-Hodgkin's, you would color in red Kansas and Nebraska, and then shade in pink Iowa, Illinois, and Wisconsin. So those are places where our use of weed killer and agriculture are most intense. So what I argue in Living Downstream, I try to argue, is not that those correlations are absolute proof of anything, but they are patterns that we shouldn't ignore, and they're like little arrows pointing us in certain directions. So just to continue with non-Hodgkin's for a moment, when you take a look at the geographic data and you see higher rates than average in our very intensely agricultural parts of our nation, and then you take a look at the occupational data and you see that indeed farmers and those who live in rural areas have higher rates than those who live in urban and suburban areas, and then you take a look at the veterinary data and you see that dogs whose owners use weed killers in the backyard have double the rate of canine non-Hodgkin's as compared to dogs whose owners don't, then you take a look at the genetic data and see that people who fumigate grain elevators have a higher than expected kind of genetic mutation in their blood cells called a DNA inversion. And the only other populations we see that mutation in are non-Hodgkin's lymphoma patients.
Mm-hmm.
I see each of these studies like little jigsaw puzzle pieces. When you look at them in isolation, they're provocative, but they don't tell you much. But when you assemble them all together, a kind of startling picture emerges. So in the end of the book, I argue that a weight of the evidence approach, rather than, you know, we have proof or we don't have proof approach, should be used to guide policymaking.
Well, let's talk about the ozone layer, too, because we hear about that a lot, that it's thinning. Tell us what your evaluation is about the ozone layer and the possibility of melanomas growing, for instance.
Well, certainly melanoma, which is the deadly kind of skin cancer, is a problem that's not only one of the most rapidly rising cancers, but it's starting to attack people at younger and younger ages.
Mm.
So the age of diagnosis is also falling. And we don't know everything about the relationship between melanoma and sun exposure. There's also interesting correlations between melanoma and certain kinds of chemical exposures.
Mm-hmm.
But we do know enough to know that the ozone layer is protective against the non-ionizing radiation that comes from the sun that we know can lead to the kind of genetic mutations in melanin-producing cells that are consistent with the kind of mutations we see in melanoma. So the more ozone we have to keep out those particular kinds of ultraviolet rays, the better. And in some ways, the ozone story is a success. This is a real success story because the Montreal Protocol really did bring the nations of the world together, and it was decided that although we didn't know everything about all the chemicals that were destroying the ozone, we knew enough to take some kind of action and that we should take a precautionary approach to this. The language that was used was something like, you know, we shouldn't wait until a pipeline of unstoppable consequences is put into place before we take action. I think those are the words of David Gee, a British thinker on all these issues. And I find that a very powerful metaphor to imagine that we get to this point where it's no longer reversible, and we shouldn't wait till we get to that point, but rather act in advance of that knowledge in a precautionary and protective way. And so we really did phase out most ozone-depleting chemicals, and all the nations of the world agreed on this. And in some places now we're seeing healing of the ozone layer.
Mm.
Now, one of the things that, on the other hand, dismays me greatly is that the U.S. has successfully gone before the U.N. and received an exemption for the use of one very powerful ozone-depleting chemical, which is a pesticide called methyl bromide, which is used especially by tomato and strawberry growers who were able to argue that they could not take this pesticide out of their farming practices and make a living. And they're right, because if you practice the kind of agriculture that they practice, you really are addicted to this pesticide and you probably couldn't grow it without it. But if you look at the way successful organic strawberry growers and tomato growers do it, it's because they have a whole different approach to farming and they're growing different kinds of crops and they're protecting the soil in different kinds of ways and they're able to kind of fool the pests through a whole other variety of techniques, thereby no longer needing to use methyl bromide. And it's the unwillingness of the methyl bromide using farmers to embrace these other techniques, which would allow them to get off, you know, break their addiction and get off the pesticide treadmill of methyl bromide, that has allowed them to keep using it. So I, as a mom, who have to think about slathering my kids with sunscreen in the summer, want my tomato and strawberry buying habits to protect my kids' melanin-producing skin cells. So for that reason, I only purchase organically grown strawberries and tomatoes. And those are the kinds of links and connections I'm really interested in helping communities make.
I was going to ask you about that. What would you recommend for people on an individual basis to be able to do to protect themselves?
Well, you know, sometimes there isn't a lot that we as individuals can do. I mean, sometimes we have to think as citizens and activists and not just as consumers. We didn't stop slavery by changing our shopping habits, you know.
Exactly.
That was something we had to do, you know.
Encouraging people to become more activists.
Sure. To remind themselves that, you know, people are citizens and we have a larger public voice, not just a private voice. Having said all that, I think that choosing to direct your food dollars toward organic farmers is a great decision, because you have to eat anyway, and by putting your food dollars toward organic, you are not only receiving food that's going to expose you and your family to lower levels of pesticides, and we have good data now to back up that you will be exposed to less if you choose organic, but also you are giving money to farmers who aren't broadcast spraying carcinogenic, birth defect causing, and ozone depleting chemicals in the environment. You're protecting groundwater, you're protecting wildlife. Farmers have higher rates of lymphoma, but farmers' kids also have higher rates of brain tumors and pediatric leukemias. So you're protecting farmers' children as well as your own.
So you're talking about organic.
Organic farmers. That's right.
Kids have
That's right.
Foods, I see.
Yeah. So you're part of, you know, you become part of the solution rather than part of the problem. And I see buying organic as a different category. I put that in a different category than, for example, buying Fiji water or buying water from France. You know, because in that case, you're directing your food dollars toward private companies who are spending lots of money making plastic bottles and burning lots of fossil fuels to carry water from Fiji to New York, when we have perfectly good water, we should, here anyway. I mean, water is heavy. It weighs 8 pounds a gallon, and burning fossil fuels to transport it all over the globe is not sustainable practice. So I put the buying of organic food in a different category than the buying a bottle of water.
Yeah, you did mention that in your book. Let's move on to, I want to talk a little bit about Having Faith, An Ecologist's Journey into Motherhood. Tell us about that book, and I know the title has two meanings.
I guess that's right. Well, my daughter's name is Faith, and she's now 7. I guess I'll leave it up to listeners to guess why a cancer patient might have a child and name her Faith. But the book is about my pregnancy with her on the brink of 40. So I became a cancer patient at 20 and a mother at the brink of 40, which I know isn't the usual order that people live their lives in, but that's how it worked out for me, which is a great blessing. And because I'm an ecologist, it actually was my first thought when I peed on that little plastic stick in the home pregnancy test kit, and there was two little lavender lines that appeared, letting me know there are now two of us instead of one, that I thought, oh my God, I'm a habitat now.
That's such an interesting term that you use for a pregnant woman's body.
Yeah, well, I spent my whole career, this 20 years of this childless biologist, studying the way organisms interact with their environments. And so suddenly I saw myself as an environment, and I saw all women as kind of the first environment for all the rest of us. And so I became really curious as to, since I'm trained to think about these things, how do toxic chemicals flow in this environment, and what risk do they create for this population of one, these little marine mammals who are swimming around in women's uteruses. So that's what really brought me from Boston, which is where I was living when I wasn't in my sister's basement, working on Living Downstream. I came to Cornell then in 1999 because they have a wonderful fetal toxicology program, and I wrote that book in residence there.
I see. And did you have people asking you why, after writing Living Downstream and learning about all these chemicals, why you would want to bring a child into this chemical mess?
I get that all the time, and I still get puzzled by the question, frankly.
Do you really?
I do. I mean, having children, and I now have a 4-year-old, Elijah, who is named after Elijah Lovejoy, an abolitionist from my hometown of home state of Illinois. It's the best thing that ever happened to me. I really did lie down, and this scene is described in the book, Having Faith. I lie down in the Beth Israel Hospital in Boston on the same ultrasound table where I had once been scanned for signs of tumor to receive my first prenatal ultrasound, you know. And I had to tell myself, if they see signs of growth this time, it's a good thing, you know, not a bad thing. So the idea that my body could grow this whole perfect human being and that I could feed it, her, out of my own body and have this symbiotic relationship known as breastfeeding is the most joyful thing I know about. And had I not, I met my husband. We kind of eloped really suddenly. I was in the middle of the book tour for Living Downstream, so we didn't have a lot of time. And I met him later in my life, and he was older, too. And I really feel if I'd got an earlier start, I would have had a house full of kids. But I was 42 when I had Elijah, and he was born here at the midwife-run birth center in Montour Falls, September Hill. And that was just I'm great at childbirth. I mean, I did it without any anesthetic. It was I didn't want, you know, the backless blue cotton gown on. I didn't want the IV drip. I associate that with all kinds of other things.
Body,
yeah. Well,
right?
I didn't want to feel like a cancer patient.
Uh-huh,
you know,
uh-huh.
I wanted to feel like an athlete. And it was amazing to me to read about childbirth. You know, a woman in labor burns up on average about 20,000 calories. It really is like running a marathon. And the idea that, you know, you could get to the final stretch of a marathon and someone would run up to you and want to inject you with narcotics, just because your legs are starting to burn, doesn't make sense. And it doesn't make sense to me when I was laboring to have my children either. I mean, I felt very powerful. It was just a very incredible experience. And, of course, as a biologist, I wanted to be all there to really feel what uterine contractions felt like. I didn't want to be doped up. And so I had great labors and delivery. I just loved every minute of it and have ever since.
Great.
Yeah. And I'm adopted. So, you know, I don't have this kind of ancestry to look back on. So, but I have these children now to look forward to.
Oh, that's wonderful. So in the same line as not wanting to be drugged up during childbirth and given chemicals, what do you think about women taking drugs for menopause?
I'm kind of getting there myself.
Yeah.
I never tell people what to do. That's another thing that sometimes my readers feel frustrated about.
But you do express your opinion.
I tell my experience.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I would never tell a woman to refuse drugs for childbirth. I would just say, here's what happened to me. You know, my style as a biologist and as a writer of autobiography is always just to say, behold, you know, here's what happened to me or here's what the data show, and make of it what you will, you know, but maybe this information is useful to you. And so, I certainly hope to approach menopause with the same curiosity and the same sort of natural approach as I approach the rest of my reproductive years. The less kind of interference, the better. I mean, I'm really in awe of the things we don't know about women's reproduction. And we're learning all the time that the ovaries actually play a role even after menopause. There are all kinds of low levels of different things that they're secreting for purposes we don't even know yet.
Mm-hmm.
That's just really, really interesting to me.
Well, we have run out of time, so thank you so much for being with us.
My great pleasure.
I do recommend both of your books. I hope people will go out and buy them and read them. They're full of fabulous information and a wonderful personal story.
Well, thanks very much.
Thank you, Sandra. Our audio producer is Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And log on to our new website at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.